time once again for Community Forum. We're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Carol Thompson and Bill All. Carol Thompson is a professor of political economy at Northern Arizona University. She has worked on issues of food sovereignty in Southern Africa for 3 decades. She is on the executive committee of the Association of Concerned Africa Scholars, which raises African development concerns within the U.S. government. She has just returned from another 5 months in Southern Africa, writing policy analysis for farmers' organizations on issues such as resisting the Green Revolution for Africa, agrofuels, biopiracy, and pollution by genetically modified organisms. And her most recent book is Biopiracy of Biodiversity, Global Exchange as Enclosure, co-authored with Andrew Mashita. Bill All, who has been on the show numerous times, is a local activist with Tools for Change and with the Community Alliance for Global Justice. And both Carol and Bill will be speaking today at a teach-in sponsored by the Community Alliance for Global Justice titled Confronting the Food Crisis, Cultivating Just Alternatives to the Corporate Food System. Bill and Carol, thank you both very much for spending time with us this morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Let's start out with you, Bill. Could you briefly tell us about the Community Alliance for Global Justice and then tell us about the teach-in that's happening today?
Sure. Briefly, the Community Alliance for Global Justice was started in the aftermath of the festivities in Seattle in 1999 against the WTO. And activists from around the community wanted to create an organization that would look at the multiple issues that are confronting us both locally and globally and to link the issues around trade and justice in the international arena with what was happening in Seattle. And we started off doing work around fair trade and against the free trade agreements over the years, and many of us participated in protests and letter writing and so on about that. And a few years ago, we decided that it was really about strengthening local economies everywhere. That was key. So linking agriculture and food justice here with what was happening on other places in Latin America and Africa. And so we still continue our work around fair trade and against free trade, but we've really deepened and enriched our approach by working with farmers and working with food justice activists in the city. And we've done several dinners highlighting strengthening local economies everywhere.
Very good. And you are sponsoring a teach-in that's happening all day today at Seattle Central Community College.
Yeah, the food crisis has really become on the top of all of our minds over the past 6 to 8 months. The media finally started to pay attention to what was going on in the world around us, and it started coming home in lots of ways in the prices that we're paying in the grocery stores and so on. And we realized that it was time for us to bring, again, that mix of people, farmers, scholars, activists together to look at all the dimensions of the food crisis. And so the teach-in is going on at Seattle Community College, Central Community College, and it's got workshops ranging from how to build your own worm bin and how to get food from lots of alternative sources to confronting the Alliance for the Green Revolution in Africa, which we'll talk about a little bit later today. This morning, and also looking at food security and food justice issues right here in Seattle. So it's really exciting, and we had a great kickoff last night with Carol, Lucy Giroux, Carlos Marentes, and Sue McCann from Mara Farms with a great panel and community discussion.
All right. Carol, you have just recently returned from the region of Southern Africa, and we're hearing right now in the news that Zimbabwe is making the news that there is a cholera outbreak or epidemic there. Can you talk about Zimbabwe and what isn't being covered in the news?
Yes, I was over 4 months in Zimbabwe until August, and I've lived approximately a total of 10 years in Zimbabwe over the last 25 years. And what is happening in Zimbabwe in terms of the news is a cholera epidemic. They're estimating over 600 people have died, which means 6,000 to 10,000 people have cholera. And as the news is also reporting, the economy is in a total meltdown. The Zimbabwe dollar continues to fall. They estimate over 200 million% inflation. And don't ask any economists what that means, because we don't know what that means. What it basically means is the people are not in the formal economy. They're sourcing food through networks, through social relationships, and growing their own food. But this is, and it is because of the tyranny of the current government. I was there during the second elections when the opposition candidate removed himself because of the corruption and the violence. And then Robert Mugabe got himself reelected as the single candidate. But no one has recognized the government or the elections. So you know all that basically from the news, but that's only half the story, because this has been going on now for about 8 years, since 2000. And why has the formal economy toppled, and how can a government possibly stay in power with that happening? So the other half of the news is that the government does stay in power through the exporting illegally of gold, diamonds, platinum, and chrome. And you've heard this before on the African continent, the incredible resources that are at the basis of conflict and mayhem and murder. What we don't talk about enough yet in the United States is who's buying the chrome, the platinum, the gold, and the diamonds. And that is the same answer that we've had for a couple of hundred years. It's the European countries and the United States. And in this particular equation, it's also South African capital. So while the United States very correctly admonishes the Zimbabwe government for the human rights abuses, it does not talk about the U.S. corporations that are profiting from the repression. One of the major U.S. corporations are buying the chrome. The gold and the diamonds go via South Africa, De Beers, South African gold fields, and the platinum is mainly through British capital and British global corporations. So basically, there will be a stalemate in Zimbabwe until the theft of the minerals becomes less profitable and the business interests want to have the economy go back into gear in terms of retail sales, tourist industry, housing. But right now, repression is very profitable.
And how do we as world citizens respond to that?
One of the issues that we need to talk about, and it has happened in other organizing, is if we just admonish the civil rights abuses, it's not sufficient. We have to do the analysis of what American corporations are profiting from repression, from torture. And that hasn't happened for Zimbabwe. And so as Americans, we need to expose those corporations and expose those economic links. And that is one of the things that the Association of Concerned Africa Scholars is beginning to organize. It's kind of amazing that you've had a lot of outcry in favor of the Zimbabwe people and their suffering, but no mention of the U.S. link to that suffering.
So one can find the direct links by following the money in this situation?
Yes. What I'm basically saying is we don't yet have the direct information, and the reason for that, of course, is this is all underground exchange, underground export. The diamonds are alluvial diamonds in the eastern part of Zimbabwe, and you basically can almost scrape them off the riverbank. So the government is involved in the corruption, it's very, very difficult to get accurate data. But there are places now that are beginning to talk about it, and we need to start organizing about it, and that hasn't begun.
All right. Along the same lines, here in Seattle, we have a local organization, philanthropic organization, that gets a lot of media play, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I didn't know this prior, but from going to the Community Alliance for Global Justice website, I found out that they are involved in a program called AGRA. And I'm wondering if you can tell us about that and tell us your thoughts on whether that's a good program or not.
Yes. Let's start with the food crisis in Africa, because generally when we think about the continent of Africa, not just about the basket case of Zimbabwe, that Africa is always in food crisis someplace, and that the continent is food deficit. The estimates are about 50 million Africans chronically malnourished, and that would be everywhere from Ethiopia, Eritrea, down through southern Africa. So one of the issues constantly under for the development of Africa are the food sovereignty and food security. Because of this chronic condition, which relates not to production of food but to the distribution of food, the Gates Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation joined together in 2006 to create the Alliance for a Green Revolution for Africa, called AGRA. In 2007, they hired Kofi Annan, the ex-UN Secretary General, to be the executive director. So they got a very high-profile person to lead their AGRA association. What AGRA is saying is that because Africa is a food deficit continent with chronic malnourishment, that they will use technology to save starving Africans. And their approach starts with improved seeds, seeds that will grow under different conditions and will have higher yields. They also are trying very much not to repeat the mistakes of the Green Revolution for Asia in India, Philippines, Pakistan, where, for instance, the seeds were used mainly by large-scale farmers, and small-scale farmers lost their land. So the AGRA initiative is paying attention to smallholder farmers. They also understand that a major issue for distribution of food is marketing, and that infrastructure is lacking across most of Africa. No bridges, no warehouses, poor roads. Therefore, their approach is that they will help the food deficit continent through technology, paying attention to smallholder farmers, and through marketing and credit to the smallholder farmers. We, however, find this unacceptable because it is the technological bullet to try to solve what is a social political problem. And the African continent really doesn't need improved seeds. They have a food base of about 2,000 plants. Their food is from biodiversity, not so much from yields. So one of the issues is, what are the improved seeds? The improved seeds in the 21st century, the new addition to a green revolution, are genetically modified seeds. Why genetically modified seeds? Their characteristics are not necessarily better than through normal breeding procedures. But genetically modified seeds can be patented. So therefore, you have a privatization of a major input resource to farmers, and they become the owners become DuPont and Monsanto, not the smallholder farmers who collectively share their seeds. The African continent is resisting this across the whole continent. All 54 countries say no patenting on life. They have a very difficult time enforcing that, but it is extremely widely accepted principle. Then the question is, well, the Gates Foundation is philanthropic. Why would they be doing this? The Gates Foundation has investment portfolios, and those portfolios are invested in biotech industries. And the accusation has been made that the Gates Foundation portfolios also have zero socially responsible criteria for their investments. So the foundation is making profit from biotech industries that are promoting genetically modified seed in order to feed food deficit Africa.
I know from reading one of your articles that you had pointed out that it was African nations that at the 1999 WTO ministerial had proposed no patenting of life forms, and that had been resisted by the U.S.
Yes. In fact, they brought a resolution that had been advocated unanimously across the continent from the African governments to Seattle, a resolution that says no patenting on life. and the United States government under President Clinton would not even allow it on the agenda in Seattle. But we also have to thank Seattle for a huge success story, and then that can give us energy to go ahead and confront what the Gates Foundation is doing with AGRA. The success story is the World Trade Organization, which came into being in 1995, is the first international law to allow patenting on life forms. But in the 1995 version of the WTO, it's simply on microorganisms. And the intention, and it's throughout the documents in the WTO, was to expand that to patenting of plants by the year 2000. So moving from microorganisms to patenting of whole species. And because of the resistance against the WTO in the streets of Seattle and Cancun and other places, resistance from organized farmers groups across Asia, Latin America, and Africa, and resistance by many governments, we're in 2008, and the WTO has no patenting on plants, still only a 1995 version of microorganisms. So Seattle initiated that resistance, and that's a huge success story that we should celebrate. It was a victory. It is a victory. There's no patenting on plants in the WTO.
Talk a bit more about Africa, where basically, my understanding is, from your writings, that the solution already exists there, that they already have, with 2,000 different plants, they already have the methodologies for, you know, putting specific plants next to each other to fight the different diseases that the U.S. biotech companies are saying that their seeds will fight.
Yes, and in fact, one way to think about it is if the Gates Foundation has so much money that they would like to contribute to world agriculture, food for people, not for profit. Our suggestion, those of us who are opposing AGRA, is why doesn't the Gates Foundation give money to African farmers to come to the United States to help us save our agriculture and revitalize it? That's how important their agriculture is. So the money's going the wrong direction. We should be bringing African farmers here to Washington to work with organic farmers. A couple of examples of the alternatives that do exist. Besides the refusing the patenting, they are also talking about farmers' rights. So farmers' rights are collective rights, the ability of farmers to exchange seed, save seed, propagate seed, no matter whose seed it is. So they will not recognize the patents, because farmers are the scientists. Farmers are the ones who have given us the incredible biodiversity, and we cannot remove them from that particular task, or we will lose biodiversity. It's a bit ridiculous to have patenting of seed, because it reduces the gene pool for breeding further seed. So the corporations are destroying the very economic base, the very resource material that they need in order to stay in business. Farmers understand that. So one of the aspects on the African continent is to herald farmers' rights and to enshrine it in their laws. Another approach, which is well known in the United States, again among smallholder farmers, and so we should have farmer-to-farmer networking, is the intercropping and the biodiversity on the farm rather than monoculture. And then the intercropping, of course, helps reduce the pests and the pathogens. Whereas if you have monoculture, it's a feast for the pathogens. One example in Ethiopia is that a genetically modified corn was introduced into Ethiopia, and Harvard Medical School actually did the research and found out that the pollen of that corn became a feast for the Anopheles mosquito, which is the propagator of malaria. So they were tracing the rise in the use in this genetically, the planting of this genetically modified corn, with the rise in malaria in Ethiopia. And it was a direct connection, because that particular plant was a feast for the mosquito. Solution, coming from Harvard, is to re-genetically modify the corn rather than going back to teff, which is an indigenous crop in Ethiopia and extremely nutritious and can do everything, can feed in every way that corn can. So the intercropping, the diversity of that, and that also then means the sustaining and propagating their indigenous seeds. Therefore, the Africans are resisting by the kinds of laws that they're passing for farmers' rights, the organizing they're doing to oppose things like the Alliance for Green Revolution for Africa, and also by their production and their marketing. And this would be very useful. The United States, we're down to about 12 plants for 75% of our food. It would be quite nice to have some African crops here and help us regain our biodiversity.
That's very intriguing, the seed that promoted the mosquito, because again, you're looking at the Gates Foundation that's going out of their way to supposedly, you know, wipe out malaria. And I don't know that it's a specific company they have an investment in, but one of their brother companies is cranking out something that is helping produce more malaria.
Yes, and it's the belief by the Gates Foundation that technology can solve any of our problems across the globe. Again, be they production problems or social problems or economic exchange problems. But in fact, this technology is highly suspect. It cannot be proven to be safe. That's why there is a biosafety protocol that's an international treaty that the United States has not signed or ratified. And that biosafety protocol says we don't have to wait to show that something is proven to be safe before we can refuse it or ban it. Because quite like an atom bomb, once you release genes and pollen that could be dangerous, you can't call it back. So the biosafety protocol is in place, and again, the African continent has ratified it across the continent to protect against this loose use of technology. And to give another example, which the Gates Foundation is invested in, sorghum is another indigenous crop across the whole continent. The sorghum and millets together are the most widely used grain than all the other grains combined on the African continent. It is indigenous to Africa. It therefore grows across all kinds of ecological regions. And it is quite unexplored genetically. So we need African geneticists, African scientists to explore the genetic wealth of sorghum. It's also more nutritious than maize. We need investment. We need funds for that research. What the Gates Foundation is invested in instead is to genetically modify sorghum in Kenya so DuPont can patent it. And that's the difference in how the money is used.
Can you give us a sense of how many or how wide the genetic, the push for genetically modified seeds and organisms in Africa is right now?
Sure. It's a very good question. There's two countries where the genetically modified organism have taken root. Kenya is one, and that's where the Gates Foundation is based. And the other one is South Africa. And let me speak about South Africa because I work in the region of Southern Africa. The rest of the region of Southern Africa has said no to genetically modified organisms. Your audience might remember in 2002 that the country of Zambia even refused to eat genetically modified corn that came in as food aid. So not only do they not want to grow it, they don't want to eat it. But South Africa has accepted genetically modified plants, and all the soya and all the maize that you eat in South Africa is now genetically modified. And then what happens, and the organization I was with, Community Technology Development Trust in Zimbabwe, has research now that has actually documented the genetic pollution coming from South Africa. For example, the food crisis in Zimbabwe that we talked about earlier means that maize corn will be coming from South Africa into Zimbabwe. It will be genetically modified. They will ship it in whole kernels, and therefore some of it will get planted. The organization, the community organization, actually was taking samples off of the sides of roads where the trucks transport the maize. And what is happening, therefore, is through the food aid from South Africa to Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe will be polluted with genetically modified maize, even though they have a national policy of no genetically modified organisms. Therefore, South Africa, with its economic power, with its ability to feed the region, is a very good conduit to force this technology on the rest of the 13 countries of Southern Africa. And it's quite explicit policy. One way you could avoid that is to ship in food aid that's already ground. So Zimbabweans have to eat the genetically modified maize, which is fine in a food crisis, but it will not genetically pollute the indigenous strains of maize in Zimbabwe, but it's going in as full kernels.
And I know the contamination also, in addition to spreading to these other plants and other regions, that another fallout from that is that the farmers can, the corporations that then have the patents on those can come in and go to these farmers whose crops are now contaminated and say, those are our seeds and you didn't pay for that and you owe us, because I know they've done that here with different farmers in North America.
Yeah, Monsanto is currently suing about 800 farmers in North America, and they're winning the suits. They're winning the suits in Canada and in the United States. And yes, that is the next tactic. When your field is polluted because a whole kernel food aid came in and took root or was planted, the corporation then comes in. And in fact, we already have on record that the corporations are saying that, well, this pollution, which was documented not only in Zimbabwe but in Namibia, Zambia, and Malawi, this pollution occurred because farmers are sharing their seeds, and farmers should not be sharing their seeds. So they take zero responsibility for a pollution which is an anathema to the biodiversity. And the biodiversity is our collective wealth, our collective treasure. And one reason the U.S. corporations are there is that Southern Africa is gene-rich. They don't have capital. They haven't got any cash. But they have genetic resources that are a treasure. And the United States is gene poor. So this is a marketing and production way to steal the genetic wealth from Southern Africa.
Well, unfortunately, a half hour is not enough time to cover this, but luckily for all of us, you are going to be speaking in town later today on a couple more gigs, and that's going to be happening at the teach-in happening at Seattle Central today, and Bill, I wonder if you can pop in and tell us about that again.
Yeah, there's going to be the hands-on and political conversations that we need to have to confront the global food crisis, and Carol's going to be speaking on two panels, one on the Alliance for the Green Revolution in Africa, and the other on intellectual property rights and genetically modified organisms, and to go deeper into both of those areas. And one of the things that's really wonderful about this teaching is that it's helping to bring back the culture into agriculture. And I think we didn't talk about it, but there's the other aspect of what's been going on with the pushing of U.S. agriculture around the world is the destruction of indigenous cultures at the privileging of our economic system and lack of culture, if you will, in agriculture. And I think that's another important part. And the teaching is about bringing it all together to celebrate the victories, as Carol was saying, and also to go deeper into how we can resist on a personal, community, and global level.
So it's like our cultural Terminator seed that we're spreading.
Exactly.
So
call that about industrial ag.
Real quick, websites people can go to.
SeattleGlobalJustice.org.
Okay. And Carol, do you have any website you want to?
The Association of Concerned Africa Scholar, which discusses these issues and others, is AfricaConcernedScholars.org.
And on genetic engineering, you could go to Washback, WBAC.org, which is the Washington Biotechnology Action Council. It has a lot of resources around looking at the intellectual property rights and GMOs.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. I want to thank you both for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.